Welcome to Indie Game Business, where you'll learn to navigate the industry with ease. This show is produced by the Powell Group, the leading business consulting firm in the gaming industry. Visit us online at indiegame.business to learn about our online digital events. We have some amazing sessions with people in the gaming industry, and you can participate for free and purchase inexpensive passes to our industry-leading business-to-business system. Now, here we go, Indie Game Business. What's up, everybody? My name is Indy, and that gentleman next to me is Mr. Jay Powell from Powell Group Consulting. Thanks for sponsoring Indie Game Business, Powell Group Consulting.
Financing, sponsoring, financing, whatever.
Yeah, and welcome to another amazing episode of Indie Game Business. And today's special guest, we got Letta J. She is in Times Square right now. She's the Coexist Gaming founder and CEO, and we're going to discuss a bunch of different things, but the title is, what does the future of the gaming industry look like? I think that's a really great place to start after we start with our very first question. Take it away, Jay.
All right. Welcome, Letta J. Awesome. You and I met earlier this week or last week or sometime. Yeah. Very. And
yes. It's all a spectrum.
Yeah, I know. So, somewhere in the past. Yes. Love what you all are doing. You are going to be at DICE as well.
Yes.
Let's start with the wonderful question that I love. Tell us how you originally got into the industry and walk us through your career to this point.
Yeah. Just make sure to unmute yourself in Discord, though, first.
Cool beans. It's like... It's like Zoom. You're on mute. All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I guess the industry is very different than how I kind of got into gaming. Originally from Dominican Republic, didn't speak a lick of English. And we get a lot of kind of like hand-me-down stuff. So I was gifted an NES and I didn't know it would change my life. My first system, and I watched firsthand when I moved to the States, grew up in Texas, how gaming can really bring community together. I was the girl with the system, and the coolest thing about it was I didn't really need to speak English, or there were no prerequisites that were really necessary to kind of begin to bond with the other neighbors, in the neighborhood. So gaming has a very special place in my heart for that reason. And I've kind of carried it with me along my journey. When I moved to New York, I moved here for music. I am a recording artist, so I signed my first record deal. And I was in like the artist box, but I was always this like huge, gaming nerd, and I used to kind of hide it. And it was like, I was a little embarrassed. It was like one of the geekier parts of me. But I wanted to just see if there were other people that were also gamers. So I was looking up tournaments online, and I found just a huge FCG, like fighting game community in New York. And I started competing. I started playing, Tekken, like a lot of retro games, Soul Calibur, Dead or Alive, Virtual Fighter. these are games I started out playing on the arcade. And I just met a lot of my very, very close friends to this day through forming community through gaming. And fast forward to now, my last tour was actually in Japan and China as a recording artist. And I went to this place in Akihabara, and I was just like astounded at this amazing place. There were two of them. One of them was kind of patterned after a specific place in China. And then another one was like a 7-story building, and they were just full of games. And I'll never forget, because I don't do a lot of touristy stuff, but I went there when they opened, and I was there until they closed. And I met all these people, and I was learning like some Japanese phrases. And I remember seeing this really weird machine where there was like a guy who was wearing a black suit, white collar shirt with a black tie next to like a kid, and they're playing this game. And it was just a beautiful moment, because I understood that gaming just had this very powerful ability to connect people across culture, across ages, across socioeconomic status, because at the end of the day, the only question we really wanted to ask was, you want to play? And so I came back to the States and I really wanted to recreate that kind of camaraderie, that community that I missed so much, that I've been searching for, and that I learned a lot of other people were searching for too.
So with your experience in Tekken, Eddie Gordo.
Oh yeah, that's my guy.
Legitimate character or piece of shit hack?
What? So this is funny. I started out with Tekken Tag, right? And Eddie is my guy.
Oh my God.
The one, listen, everybody can't play Eddie. There are people that are button mashers, okay? And so they end up getting a couple kicks in, but in order to play really skilled fighters, Lee and Anna, like, you gotta know the mechanics and the timing. It's like timing is everything, especially with your offense, particularly with any character that is a capoeira-based character. Just because, you know, you're flipping, you're on hands, you've got legs in the air, the movement is really important. Now, it is, I will say that I do think it's easier on the sticks, at least the way arcade cabinets used to be designed, like easier in the sense of you can learn some combos very quickly that just kind of allow you to just keep smacking somebody. With the controller, I do find it's different. I generally compete with my arcade stick, but it's not a hack. Now, I will say they have made more complex, thankfully, more complex characters. They did it with Elena with Street Fighter. But I also feel some kind of way that all of the characters with African descent, they're like, or even the Latino ones, they're always capoeira characters. I need some.
Wait, well, who else is? I mean, honestly, Eddie Gordo was the only one that I haven't played nearly as many, but how many
Jackson,
more capoeira are there?
Street, Elena from Street Fighter, Mariposa from Dead or Alive. There's characters even in Mortal Kombat that when they're like, they use the mechanics, but they're always generally like brown people. Always. I know it's a Brazilian art and I know Brazil is very black, but it's like the first time I saw an iteration that deviated from capoeira was in Tekken 7 when they came out with Leroy and he was at least doing kung fu.
To be fair, none of us white people have enough rhythm to do that anyway. Yeah. So it's always been the folks that can play competitive level fighting games. I love just sitting there and watching them because then you hear them talk about, and they talk about how many frames per second that they have to make a decision. And I'm like, that's just absolutely crazy. Anyway, I'm so impressed. But yes, Eddie Gordo has always been like my most hated character. Long story. You can't tell me a lot of button mashers don't pick Eddie Gordo when they start playing.
It's true. You know, I think they pick Eddie because he looks cool. And then they learned that there are only so many combinations, I will say, with Eddie. So he's not the most complex character. But that's why in order to win with Eddie, you really have to, you got to know timing, which means, so the challenge is people that win with Eddie, like, and the difference between somebody mashing buttons versus someone who's actually kind of more of a skilled player is you have to learn the other players. You have to learn where their strengths are, so that you understand how to win against them, because a lot of them are just more complex and more tactical players.
And once again, we've gone through one question and then completely.
I know. Okay, we can't do this.
No, this is the entire show.
Okay, good. I love
this. This is exactly what we do. Tell everybody a little bit about what Coexist Gaming is, all the stuff that you've done, because that is the sense of it. We can get into where we think the industry's going, aside from the dumpster fire that it's been for the last like 8 months.
Yeah.
But it's really important about, I love that, you know, premise of games bring everybody together. You don't have to be able to speak English because you've got the businessman standing next to the kid and playing. Right. And that's the way we all grew up. And that's for better or worse, while we're still in this industry.
Right.
Tell us what you built and let's go from there.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the kind of like the one-liners or like the Coexist Gaming is this, it's a lifestyle-based company for individuals who enjoy gaming, social interactions, and entertainment as a part of living a balanced and dynamic life. So we are the first membership-based gaming company ever. My goal was to break the play-to-pay model, right? Like, I wanted to disrupt the psychology of once you're done spending money playing games here, there's nothing else for you to do. So it's like, you know, kudos to Barkade for paving the way and for Dave & Buster's for being like cool spots for you to go and have birthday parties and things like that. But unfortunately, they are not places that necessarily foster community. And so our members are comprised of a really diverse community of creators, thought leaders, industry professionals, developers, like you name it, literally from entertainment, you know, what the world now calls as esports. So the competitive aspect of gamers to developers. And we finally all get to coexist. So one thing that was really important to me when I started this company, which I did in my Brooklyn duplex in 2019, I had a really cool Brooklyn apartment. It was two floors. It had three rooms and a backyard. And I used to Airbnb the rooms, but I had so many gaming systems that I actually put them in the rooms and I launched my Airbnb as a gaming Airbnb. So I had an Xbox room, a PlayStation room, and a Nintendo room. And when I wasn't booked, I was like, I'm gonna throw a gaming party, you know? So I just put on social media, we're having a gaming party, had some friends over. A lot of my close friends, I've been working in hospitality since I was 12. So I love to cook. I'm like, I've worked in, you know, really great restaurants. I'm a wine sommelier. So I was like, I loved making food and just, it's kind of one of my languages, serving, you know, my friends. And so it became this hub where if you were an artist, a gamer, any across the spectrum, you know, whether you wanted to compete or just chill, whatever, put a game that you built on the screen, it was a place for us to literally coexist. Fast forward to now, right? We opened up three locations in Brooklyn. So that first duplex, we outgrew in like 6 months. We launched our membership, which we walked into the door with 100 members that were paid subscribers. And we did a lot of surveys, you know, so it was really kind of funny. I used to cosplay at our parties, which it was a monthly event. And I remember one day I cosplayed as Keita from Atlantis. And so, you know, Keita wears a blue bikini. And I did it on purpose because I knew I was going to be walking around with an iPad asking people questions. Like, there's nothing more annoying than a person at a party asking survey questions. But I did it, and I was like, if you ask questions, you know, you get a free shot. But of course, I was like, who's going to say no to Keita? And so
I was thinking, who's going to say no to a free shot? But that's beside the point.
True. But that came after, because first you got to, like, at least let me get to the question, you know? And so I lured them in, but a lot of the data we learned, you know, we asked questions like, you know, if this was something that were available regularly, would you come out to it? And, you know, there were a lot of unanimous yeses. You know, if, because our, to, at one, like, we got to the point where instead of it being just kind of like a gaming party, we charged like at the door, it was like $10, you know, and you had access to all of the games for free. And that was really that was the beginning of our model to, you know, have this library of games where the community could just experience that nostalgia of retro, relive their childhood, but then be excited about games that were currently out, that were exclusive to certain consoles. And we were hosting the tournament. And the tournaments, the most exciting part about it was usually when we went to tournaments, like we were at a Tekken tournament, or you're at a Smash tournament, or you're at a Call of Duty tournament. So that means you're siloing the arcade fighters, the, you know, the traditional, you know, street like fighters, the console based gamers, the shooters that are playing, you know, either on maybe like Xbox or PC, but they never came together. So we started doing tournaments that brought the fighting game community, sports community, the shooting game community all in one. And we would have an itinerary of about five tournaments happening every hour on the hour in different rooms on different floors. And it was exciting because people started to meet the people they fanned. And so all of this, I say this because all of this really became what our ecosystem is now. The goal was to get into our first commercial space. So we took all three of those spaces, where one of them was the Coexist Game House, which had just like, had about 5,000, 5 to maybe 8,000 video games in that one space, all just free to play to enjoy. And then we learned from those surveys that a lot of our members were content creators and artists, and they were in real estate and finance and all these industries because they're just us. And so we launched another space that was a content creator house, and it was a 3-story townhouse, 6 rooms, 10 sets. We had about 30 podcasts being filmed out of that space. And then there were a lot of people on the outside that kind of heard about this gaming house, you know, and they wanted to host like birthday parties and stuff like Dave & Buster's, but at a place that they could do things that were not just about like sitting on big machines. We really wanted to kind of take it back to their childhood a little bit. We had a lot of retro. So we had these 3 places. They all serve different purposes. The goal was to combine them all into one that would allow us to still live and breathe in our commercial space. And that's where we are now. We opened up last year, or it's been a year, and we're steps from Times Square. It's 3 stories. It's full of over 20,000 games. And now it has everything from the Atari 2600 to PC games, every next-gen system, all the retro consoles, Sega Genesis, Dreamcast, Saturn, NES, Super, 64, GameCube, Xbox, original 360, Series S, X, PlayStation 1 through 5. It's like all the things. all the stuff.
So I'm such like the business geek, and I will totally admit that. The fact that you're throwing parties and doing surveys in the middle of them, So what were you surveying? What were you trying to find out?
Yeah. So we wanted to understand if forming a subscription, a membership, is something that the gaming community wanted. It didn't exist. There just wasn't an example of it. And we needed to know, you know, people were coming back every single month. And we started out with like 50 people, ended up with over 500 people, and lines out the door of this apartment. And, you know, we were just like, okay, so I'm definitely going to get kicked out of this place. but it's like, before I do, I'm going to get this information. And so really what I wanted to know was, if we open this up to 3 days a week, you know, would you all come here? If we gave you a price per month, you know, do you see the value in this being a part of what you want? And it was a unanimous yes. And that's exactly what I did. I had the 2 floors. My personal space was downstairs. So I actually converted downstairs, because I still had Airbnb guests that it booked on the other 3 floors upstairs. I turned downstairs into a complete game room that was not only available to the members, it was also available to the people that were visiting and staying at the Airbnb, and they could pay for a day pass. So I completely monetized that unit, but also learned that, you know, we just wanted places to be around people we had things in common with, which I knew that because we go to conventions all around the world. Mm-hmm. And while some of these conventions, right, the expos, the summits, they are more on a B2B level. Most of the conventions are not. They're exclusively B2B. We're playing games that are unreleased. We're playing in tournaments. We're at Evo. We're at Frosty Frostings. We're at Comic-Con. We're just in cosplay. We're Anime NYC. And all of these cultures are under the diaspora of the gaming world. And we wanted to just be around these things more often.
You can't let people know that when we go to these B2B events that we actually still are playing games, because that's going to destroy our entire rep of we're here to do business. But yes, we are sitting around playing a lot of games in the meantime.
Yes,
so esports has been, I almost look at it, and I've told people, it's almost like a different vertical from the rest of the game space. It is separated out to the side. I have my opinions on why.
Yeah.
But from your side, and obviously being much more involved in it than I have been, where do you see it going? And do you see more of a core mixture, so to speak, with the rest of the gaming world?
Yeah. And I'll answer that, but I definitely do want to hear your thoughts. I want to hear your thoughts about why you feel like they're so very polarizingly separated. So for one thing, I've been saying this since before I started Coexist, particularly in 2020, because there were tens of billions of dollars that were raised in institutionalized funding, and everybody was just talking about esports. Mm-hmm. And as a former esports competitor, right, I know the neglect in that sector of gaming, right? We're talking about 63%, not even 1% of the whole industry, who's playing competitively on a high level. You are I mean, neglecting yourself sounds like it sounds like an overstatement because an understatement significantly, because you're not eating well. You were playing countless hours. The competition is full of anxiety. It's rife with a lack of wellness. These are things that were important to me in terms of our ecosystem. But I think the biggest separation and why we focus so much on really bridging that gap is you still have a very dedicated sector of like a significant number of people in the gaming community who are spending countless hours perfecting gameplay. That means you love this game and you love the escapism, the whether it's catharticism or the peace, whatever it is that it gives you so much, that you are perfecting this as a statement you're making, whether it's to yourself or to the greater community. But when you show up at that tournament, it's time to show everything you've got. It's on display. You are now competing with the best of the best. There's a mentality behind the person and that discipline, that those pattern of behaviors. That person is ambitious. That person is tenacious. They are committed and they are relentless. What they're not given the opportunity to do is have that commitment optimized, which is why, I mean, I don't know one person that competes that would love anything more than to be a part of building a game that they love so much that they're learning to play it. My goal is to really create pipelines of opportunity where the players can actually be a part of the development process. And I do think that's a really big part of where the future of gaming is as it relates to esports and the greater gaming community, particularly in the development sphere. There's that, and then there's the education behind it. A lot of schools and education are looking at esports as a way to build community, because it always has, form this camaraderie. And the way they think about that is in the form of a team. The business model, of course, as we saw as people in the gaming industry, it wasn't sustainable and it certainly wasn't scalable. If you need, you know, 50 to 100,000 square feet to scale your concept and everyone's vying for the same sponsorships and you're just relying on like ticket sales and you've got this massive piece of real estate, the tournaments, you're only having tournaments so often, you know, so it's kind of like you're now investing in a bunch of real estate with the intention of having these grandiose tournaments. Getting sponsorships, I mean, companies only have so much money. It's just not a sustainable model. So that way to monetize esports, I understand why the world outside of gaming did it. It's all they knew. They looked at a stage. They understood, okay, we've got artists. We're going to put stars on stage, butts in seats, sell food, drinks, and tickets. And that's the same model that they apply to esports. But they never, this is why I say representation is so important. They never asked us.
Yes.
They never asked us. And it's like, this is our world. We're in it. We're breathing in it. And you just got here and you don't know anything about it. And you also don't care about us. You just want to capitalize on us. And you're not even asking what we want. But for me, that when I saw all those people in the seats, they were really the bigger part of the opportunity. These are not just the spectators. These are the lovers of that game too. And while they're not competing on a high level, they are waiting for an opportunity to engage.
So we're on the same page with the whole, it's unsustainable.
Yeah.
A lot of the reason that, you know, when I have friends of mine who aren't in the industry, because the first thing they see is they're flipping on ESPN and they saw a League of Legends or they saw a Hearthstone tournament or whatever. And they're asking me about it. And I'm like, it's not the core of what I do. And part of it is because we do have that separation between AAA and indie. And that's what, you know, I tell people, it's like, look, if you look at an iceberg, AAA is that top of the part that you see out of the water. That's what everybody sees.
Right.
That's the small number of games that are the most visible.
Yes.
I was like, but our world is underneath the waterline and it's massive and not as many people see it.
Correct.
And esports has historically been dominated by games coming from the AAA studios.
Yes.
And it's we just saw it with Overwatch. One, God, what the fuck was the point of Overwatch 2? I still don't understand why they did that. I'm not happy with it, but that's my own rant. The other side of it is, if something happens with these games, and we see it from Nintendo with Smash.
Yes.
if they just decide that they don't want to support that platformer anymore, they just kill it off. And the tournaments, the organizers have fuck all they can do about it because it's not, you know, their game. They don't have any. So it's like we're constantly investors are chunking things into this that is living on such an edge in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's before, like you said, the unhealthiness of it all.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of the same stuff that we see with developers themselves.
Yes.
It's like, you know, I say constantly, it's not, let me be clear before I get completely flamed online for this. No, it is not our fault. It is not the person's fault.
Right.
But we do live in an industry where it's so glamorous, except for those of us who have been doing it for 25 years. Yeah. It's everybody wants to work in games, and so they're willing to drive themselves to sickness and illness to do it.
It's true.
And it's the same with these athletes. I actually met a crew from, I can't remember if they're from Ireland or from Wales, and it was a group of doctors, and they were basically beginning their, you know, company on, we're doing wellness checks and you know, teaching esports teams how to take care of their players because they steal. It's like, oh, we have a team. Let's shove all of you into a house.
Right.
You know, male, female, everybody, you're in your late teens, early 20s, hormones are crazy.
Right.
And we're going to feed you Red Bull and you're going to play for 18 hours a day. It's like, what the fuck is that?
Yes.
So, I absolutely love the esports side in the fact that it's like golf to me. You know, I can watch Travis Kelce and he's extremely amazing, but I also know that even if this was 20 years ago, I can't play a tight end on a professional football team. I'm not big enough. I was not granted the best genes. But you watch golf and you're like, you know what? If I practice enough, I can play golf. It doesn't matter how old I am. And that's the same way esports is. It's approachable. It's something that you know, everyone can be involved in.
It's true. I agree.
But it's like still so – that's why I look at it as it's a completely different vertical in many ways than what we do.
You know, it is. But you pointed out something that really brings them together. That lack of wellness, it happens in development too. You know, like you're talking about two groups of people, first of all, playing. You got the players playing all these hours. You got developers coding and building all these hours. Crunch is real. The same anxiety, right? But the stakes are, honestly, the stakes are high on both depending on the level you're on.
Yeah.
You're in. You know, the lack of support is still the same. So I think that what I want so badly, because I'm on both ends of that spectrum. Granted, my degree is in electrical engineering. I still serve as a music director for games and everything music and sound. And I'm a part of this development process, even on a project management perspective, just knowing that these are the creative positions that can really make great games. I want to make this perspective more pervasive. I want to disseminate it so that it is more ubiquitous, so that there is a greater pipeline of entry for the greater community. Because the alternative is people gravitate to games, some of them just because they need something to attach themselves to that is good for them, that doesn't harm them. And games don't harm you, right? Granted, there are some toxic communities, unfortunately.
The people playing them harm
you. The people playing them. But the games themselves are inspiring, you know, even empowering and also educational. And so we focus a lot, like, you know, when I talk about like our ecosystem and, you know, our incubator is, which I formed because I realized the opportunity is just in development. And I feel like I've been screaming this to particularly VC to the point where I just get tired of talking to them because they're not listening. But our goal was to form an ecosystem that was full of programming that allowed people to simply understand how they could dip their foot in the water, you know, to know how they fit in the development sphere. Because if a AAA game hires hundreds, if not thousands of people, our goal was to, one, make better games, introduce more people to form teams so that now we can start to build more studios that could even hone in on specific areas and aspects of gaming, whether it's art and animation or design, whatever it is. We wanted them to have the resources they needed so that when other studios that either existed or that were being formed needed resources, they could lean on those. And it became a cyclical process. And the way to do that was really through building community.
Heather, if you're out there listening, could we please stop bringing people onto this show who have accomplished so much in their life that it makes me look like a fucking idiot every day? You know?
What?
Look, you grew up in the Dominican Republic. You come over here. You don't speak any English. You have an electrical engineering degree now. You're starting all these companies. And I'm like, hey, I've got a consulting firm and I run a podcast. There we go. It is absolutely impressive and inspiring. And I love these conversations because
well, thank you, Jake.
It's just absolutely, and it does.
But you know what?
Sit back and go, what the hell did I do? Yeah.
Well, you're doing it, right? Like, I'm on here because this is a platform that you've leveraged your resources and your relationships to build, and you're giving voices. It's so important.
That's so nice of you to say that. I won't tell you why we actually started this podcast. Anyway, so really good question coming in. So esports and subscription gaming spaces for adults are big in East Asia and South Korea, especially. What do you think the strengths and weaknesses of that model are in the U.S.?
What do you think are the strengths and weaknesses of that model? Okay, so I'll tell you, the biggest weakness is, man, I live this. When I say we want to bridge the gap, one of the biggest gaps is a digital divide. You're talking about if you look at the FGC, right, which is, these are the largest tournaments outside of MOBAs, right? We're talking about Evo level, Vegas to Japan. The fighting game community is full of Black and Brown people, majoritarily. These are groups of people. These communities are so marginalized, they cannot afford $3,000 PCs. So therein already lies a disconnect. Now,
wait, come on.
Yeah.
Where is it costing $3,000 to compete?
No, the PC that you need to practice on.
Well, okay.
Yeah, right. That digital divide works from esports to development. You need processing power. You need refresh rates. You need hertz. You need monitors. You need those PCs.
I thought you were saying that it was like a $3,000 entry fee to some of these tournaments.
And oh, no. I mean, honestly, some of them, it's more than that for like the teams, but that's on a high level and they're usually funded. But the weakness, I think, is that you have one culture. So like for particularly like some of this stuff, you know, for the person that asked that question, it's a great question. Unfortunately, some of these things are systemic and political. You have certain Asian territories that their government understands the reach and the grasp that gaming has to the entire demographic. So they're supporting it and they are contributing to why people can access games on a level that enables them to monetize it. So unlike the U.S., which, by the way, the U.S. was competing with Canada until recent. Now, China has surpassed the U.S. in terms of revenues being generated with in gaming, the number of players. And a big part of that is societal. If you see that most of the players are from, you know, they're from Korea, they're from London, they're from Germany, Sweden, these are now people that become your inspiration. You are now diving into what their lives are like, what they're doing, what's their trajectory in order to step into those roles. A big part of that is simply telling your parents, your support group, hey, I need this PC. I need this because this is the only way I'm going to be able to do this. And I live in a territory that supports my dream.
You have got to check out our Discord at discord.gg/indiegamebusiness. It's an amazing community of over 3,500 other industry experts. We've got developers, publishers, marketing and PR firms, investors, so many. It's a safe and supportive place to network and to talk to experts. You can learn more about the business of games, or you can share what you know with others. We have exclusive workshops on perfecting your pitch deck, finding a publisher, and more. Remember, it's discord.gg/indiegamebusiness.
In America, for one thing, this country is still learning gaming. It's like 4 decades old, but we are just now approaching an understanding of how it can be monetized, which is why everyone in America pounced on esports to begin with. Because as I said, they likened it analogous to the artist model. Arena, artists on stage, butts in seats, tickets, sponsors, food, beverage. That's the model. And so they could immediately apply that to esports. And then they took the traditional sports model and said, we're going to apply this to esports. We're going to create teams and we're going to make these teams worth tens of millions of dollars so that we can franchise them, which to Jay's point now only lends itself to AAA games, which in large part just shines a light on development in the way that is not conducive to the actual point of why development can be so broadly monetized, it and why the opportunity in development matters. But can you grab this for me, please? But the so in some in terms of the strengths, that it's their territory. They have supported a entire system that supports the dream of people who want to play games competitively. In America, you just don't have that. Granted, we have teams like NBA 2K. Jacin, can you please go in there? Sorry. The NBA 2K League has a league. You can draft players, but they're making like $30,000 to $40,000, maybe $50,000 a year. We have some people that are, you know, I don't know, sponsored by people. Is it enough to make a living? I don't know. Maybe, depending on where you live. But I think this is a weakness because I think it's giving people false hopes and dreams. I think the biggest weakness, honestly, is the lack of, you know, hardware and software, because you need both. And I think it's, listen, I don't like blurring the lines. There are very pointed and acute lines between esports and development, and they are way over here. I want to bring them together. I want them to coexist, because at the end of the day, the communities do need each other, and they lend themselves to creating more opportunity when they come together. And there are ways to do that, and providing access and resources are generally the ways that those things can start to coexist.
I love that point about America's not there, because it's the, yes, we had a ton of companies jump in and like, oh, we're going to invest in esports.
Right.
But one, South Korea has been doing it for 27 years.
Yes.
And doing it well.
Yes.
Now, they're still doing it with StarCraft II. And we were down at DreamHack. There was a StarCraft II competition going on. And it was absolutely amazing how many people were sitting there watching it.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, what we look at in terms of fostering business, the U.S. is way the hell behind a lot of these companies. I mean,
yes.
Canada has so many tax incentives.
Agreed.
All you literally have to do is move across the border. And okay. You've got the CMF funding, which is big, but you've also got, you know, incentives from every single province and all of that sort of stuff too. Germany, a lot of European countries have grants and tax breaks for right. companies. In the U.S., we don't. It's like right. Louisiana has them. Georgia has them.
Right.
And North Carolina, where I am, used to have them until right. the conservative government took over and went, oh, we don't need this anymore.
Right.
And that's why all the Marvel movies are made in Atlanta and not in yeah. Wilmington anymore. But it's like, you know, for a country that is like so slow to support the industry, and then all of a sudden they jump in, it just, it's frustrating as all.
Yes. I agree. Listen, if America did what so many other territories, like even Saudi Arabia, Dubai, they have invested over $30 billion for gaming to revolutionize their economy.
Yeah, but they also have like what I refer to as FU money.
No,
because it's like they can throw anything. They, I mean, for God's sakes, they started an entire golf league and pissed off the PGA. I mean,
you're right. But I do think that it matters if you have 7.7 billion people in the world and almost 4 billion of them identify as gamers.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth investing in. It's worth understanding. Like I'm talking about it's worth, and this is why I play at this like high level of conversation. I go to like UN meetings and meeting with, you know, president of teams that are interested in emerging tech and bringing it to different continents like Africa. This is why I love to build physical and digital infrastructure, because these conversations need to be happening. This is why we are targeting. So I would work with the mayor's office and all this stuff, because you've got a bunch of people that do not play games. They are not in the industry. And they're all seeing the numbers, they're seeing statistics about these people, and they just start formulating solutions. It's like, how are you creating solutions you haven't spoken to one person with the problem? If it's not your problem, you don't know to create a solution for it. So where is this arbitrary stuff coming from?
It makes them look good on paper. See, you have that level of patience that you can deal with the politicians. I just can't. I can't do it. It's like they don't. I think it's going to take another 10, 15, 20 years until more of my generation, and I'm going to label you in a generation younger than me, because I'm assuming you are. And until more of us that grew up as gamers, you know, get to our 70s or 80s, where you obviously have to be elected to be a politician in this country, that's when we're going to see the changes. Right now, we're still got. They just don't. They look at it, and I get a kick out of every time I'm at any kind of conference and a politician comes to speak, because they're reading off note cards, bullet points.
Jassim.
So we can't.
Can you hear come open the door, doing. Please?
It's all good, but it's frustrating because they don't know what we're doing. They don't understand, you know, the difficulties of it, and they are just coming up with random to do in the meantime.
I agree.
Too much of a rant.
This is. Good. I like rants. Rants are necessary.
So, what can be done at the basic level? I mean, here in the U.S., we don't have those tax incentives. One of the biggest concerns that I see, and I have a lot of indie teams come to me, and they're pitching their game, and they're like, "We're going to make it viable for esports," and I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa."
Right.
Don't go too far down that rabbit hole yet until you've got, you know, at least some support going behind it, and you've got a building, a community building up, because otherwise you're going to invest a bunch of time and money into something that it's not going to pay off. What can developers in particular do to get involved in these things so it's not all AAA games that we're seeing, you know, at the conference, at these tournaments?
Yeah. So I think, to be honest with you, this is something that we're working on every day. This is why our incubator is so important, because when we host, you know, things like game jams, our goal is to not just create a bunch of games that don't have the fidelity and the quality of a game that's truly playable. We want to continue to form these partnerships, bring in these business relationships so that we can leverage their allocated budgets to provide more resources to the development teams, so that we can continue to have games that then when we have conversations with the public sector, with the mayors, we get to have, like, one, I sit on the gaming committee for the city of New York, and, you know, these town hall meetings, working with them, understanding, look, these are some of the things that we need in terms of bringing together other nonprofits so that we can just try to not leave money on the table. We have to use all of the access we have so that we can continue providing resources so that the games are good, so that they're better games. And then we have these worlds that we're building. Like, for me, all of this is, it's a circle. It's cyclical. It's like, we have to start somewhere. So phase one was, we need places to gather because we're doing things, but we're doing things that are not necessarily sustainable for everyone. So going to conventions all over the world is not always easy for everyone. So by having a place where the gaming community can come together, gather, and from there, yes, we can meet on Discord and other social platforms, but it does matter and it resonates differently when there is an in real life experience. So scale of places that are scalable matters. And then when you have these ecosystems that have incubation as a part of them, it enables you to leverage the community you have to understand who they are, what they do, what their goals are, so that we're channeling them now. into respective categories. You now understand your developers in terms of programmers and software developers, your music and content creators, you have your animators, you have your graphic design artists, you have your narrative writers, you have people in fashion, people that are historians, you have people that know QA. You're literally taking all these people and understanding what they can contribute to the development process. And now, when you host an event that allows games to be built, you are making companies spend money because they want this development, they want this engagement, they want this content, but the byproduct are better games. You now get to navigate these better games to where they're playable games. And now, as a part of your world, you have a community that is excited about playing these games. So when you have your showcase, you're bringing on, yes, more publishers and relationships, but you got to get there first. And that community is very, very helpful in determining how good these games can be and how good we need to make them.
So, all right, this is a good segue. So what can we do to bridge that gap between more gamers and players and getting them into development?
I think that they need to understand what development means. I think that it's not enough to just, if please just answer it. I think it's not enough to, it's not, you know what? I spend a lot of time working on the branding of things. Being an electrical engineer is not sexy until I open up a gaming console and I pull out the circuit, or I talk about a CRT and people are like, oh man, that's the old school TV. And I'm like, yeah, so this is a cathode ray tube and this is how it works. And it matters that the representation is there, that there is a level of engagement. It's Amazon. And it just, I say that because to contextualize development, it means that you are extrapolating what it's comprised of. Development is as creative as it is technical. I am as creative as I am technical. And it's important that, that I'm a part of the development process and I work with studios and I work with devs all the time. And I get to bring in all sorts of resources because that's what makes better games. It's what AAA and AA studios do literally all the time. They are in position to contact other studios who specialize in this and they get to hire the best people. But on a ground level, why are we simply not doing that? Why are we not leveraging the existing community so that they can be a part of this process?
So is part of it, would you say we're educating them about development? I know I do this with people, but I've also been doing this for a very long time, and some might say I'm cynical. If you are absolutely going in and telling them the truth about what it's going to be like to be a game developer, it's not that we don't sit around and play games all day. It right. is hard work.
Yes.
It is long hours. It is little, you know, feedback, and it is little money for a lot of it as well. Is it a situation where, you know, we just simply have to be that honest with people? It's like, look, this is not all shiny, happy. I'm going to play Tekken all day.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, this is why I do these things because, and again, I can't place enough importance on representation. When I'm on stages, my goal is to be on stages that matter. So then I say these words and they're like, you're a gamer. And I'm like, yes, I'm a gamer. I've been a gamer my whole life. I've been playing video games my entire life and I can speak to our issues. And it matters that we say this on the biggest mics. Because this society, and I say it, and so to the persons asking on Discord, this is a part of American society. We have contextualized what tech looks like and who's a part of tech. What does that mean? We need to stop attributing these meaningless values to industries. Gamers are people. We are not robots. It matters that we help them understand that we eat food, that we don't oil ourselves with WD-40, that we, you know, sleep, that we need rest, that we need balance, that we have goals, that we have dreams, that we want opportunities, that yes, we play these games because sometimes, as one person wrote a letter, says the games that we play are more enjoyable than real life. But at some point, those characteristics in the game that we love, that we gravitate to, we need to bring them to life. Those, they're worlds. Like, we play RPGs because we get to determine, we get to make choices, right? In a world that we didn't build it, but we contribute to the entire experience that's curated. I think we would build more worlds if we had access to not just the resources, but an understanding of where we fit into this process. And that's a really big part of what I'm just like, I'm jet set on making. It is a mission of mine as an artist who is an engineer. And I can't divorce my either of them. I say I'm a creative engineer because I no longer can fit into one box. As an artist, I am pragmatic and calculated and logistical. And that's generally not something that people, society may deem artist as characteristics of an artist. And then as an engineer, I'm bringing creativity to the tech world and the space. And I'm like, well, what if we consider this? So I think it matters when we have those minds that are in a room having conversations, whether that room is physical or virtual, that the representation is so on point that we're now having conversations that are optimized so that the byproduct of those conversations are solution-based, executionable action items that say, we're going to shake this up, or we're going to do this differently. And you know what you're going to find? You are going to find, I think, studios that are going to be formed, more people forming portfolios with catalogs of games. They're going to have networks where they can reach out to people that are in creative spaces and say, hey, I'm building this game. I love your music on this platform. You know, are you interested in being a part of this game with me? Hey, I really love your art on like ArtStation. This is so awesome. Oh man, I follow you on like DeviantArt and I would love to work with you. Like, we just need to have conversations, and it's happening. It's happening slowly, but I feel like every time I talk to someone, their mind gets expanded. It's like, oh, right. Games are beautiful. It's why every TV is trying to make their game with OLED and QLED technology better than the next one so that they can now really optimize this, the beauty of the visuals that are created in the development process. And everybody, like, they're catching on, you know, but it matters that people start seeing this stuff. It's like, yeah, so all these colors and all of this, you know, this the 4K, the 8K, you know, screens that you all are selling us, and 144 hertz game modes and all of these things they're doing, Dolby, creating Atmos and Vision and trying to leverage gaming in order to appeal to us. But we're not breaking down the nuances of what the jobs are in order to make those games.
And a lot of people still, this is the fight that I fight every day. A lot of people think being a game developer means you're being a coder or an artist, right, or a designer, and that's it. And there's way more to it. So on the, you know, accessibility route in terms of getting people interested, Lee's got a good point that I think is very pertinent these days.
Okay.
Have you all looked into using Fortnite Creative as a community builder for game jams? And the same would go for Roblox. Some of these more easily accessible tool sets to be used as the building point to game, because we're starting to see now developers and even publishers who are solely focused on these user-generated platforms.
Yes. So actually, I was just on a call. I sit on a board with the chief of staff of Roblox, and you know, we have a call about an activation that we're doing. Was just on a call with Epic and Unreal. So specifically the education part of Epic, where they have a team that teaches people how to use the Unreal editor, particularly in Fortnite. My only issue is that they have, it doesn't work in schools. So there are platforms that I'm a big fan of, like, I don't want to say it wrong, dot Big Bang. And just definitely check it out. Let me make sure I'm saying it right. And I'm giving them a shout out because I think what they've done is really phenomenal. It is a platform that literally allows you to dive in and start creating games. It's object-oriented coding, and it's really great on mobile. It's better on Android. I do have an iPhone. I have an Android also, but it's definitely better on Android. But I just think it's an excellent tool that doesn't, there's no red tape. As soon as you go to that, you know, site, you are in the world of where games can be built and played. And I think it's this, these kinds of points of entry that start to really help educate, because, you know, Roblox is great, but their world is very insulated. You know, Minecraft works in schools because they don't have some of these barriers of entry. You don't have to have individual servers. You don't have to create all these kind of logins. Now, mind you, in our space, we can circumvent some of these things, because, you know, we can set everything up before kids get here and they're not the same kind of security protocols that are in schools. But I do think it matters when there are engines that understand how to alleviate barriers of entry. I think that's really important.
I thought Big Bang is new to me, and I've already pulled it up. And yes, I mean, aside from the fact that our school systems most of the time don't have a computer that'll even run Fortnite. I mean, that's one of the biggest issues as well. So yeah, these things that are completely web-based make way more sense. Yeah. All right, so Lee's got a question. My pitch deck shows the esports potential for our multiplayer skate shooter, but I was told I shouldn't mention it since it may be deteriorating. Esports is not our focus, but we are open to it. What are your thoughts?
All right. So one, I'm just going to kind of go off the top here because I would like to know more specifically what the model of your business is. If esports is not your focus, then why focus on it? It is definitely deteriorating. Now, it will, the thing is, esports, it's going to just become a term, I think. I'm trying to dismantle it, but it's going to become a term that becomes more all-encompassing for video games because it's just the first introduction to the greater society. They hear esports, they immediately think of games. They don't, like we know, regard it as exclusively the competitive sector of gaming. Hopefully we will continue educating them so that they can learn that and stop using that term. But I think if you are focused on, let me see the question again, if possible. I want to know what you're focusing on specifically. Let me see. My PJ shows esports potential for our skate shooter. So yeah, if it shows the esports potential, what does that mean to you? Are you focusing on this shooter being exclusively competitive, or is it just a monetization contribution to what you've built? If you're focused on the development of your game, the strongest, I think, thing you should focus on is your business model. How are you making money? You built it, so you spent money on it. If you're, you know, you're looking for potential investors to invest it to make the game better or whatever, more robust, talk about how you're making money in that game. And if you are, I don't know what aspect of esports you're including outside of it just being competitive, you can lean on, I think you can lean on esports statistics to lend credibility to how this percentage of gamers will gravitate to your shooter based off of, you know, Apex or CSGO or, you know, COD or what Halo, whatever it is. Use your references to show this percentage of gamers have gravitated to these type of games. So we believe that they're going to gravitate to our type of game, and they've generated upwards to this amount of money. So therein lies a top-down perspective of how much market-wise you can make. Exclude things, obviously, like franchises and teams and things like that, because it becomes a reach. That's the part of esports that has been dismantled already. So you definitely don't want to lean on that. But I think you may be in the position to leverage those existing success of other shooters while simultaneously focusing on the fact that if you built it, you know, focus on your monetization model. If you've got microtransactions in there, leverage the heck out of Fortnite and everything that EA does, because, you know, they drive us crazy with all their microtransactions. God, yes. But, you know, don't go to that extent, but you can actually use them as comparable. So in your pitch deck, I think one of the strongest things you can have is a comparable slide, whether that's a shooter, something with microtransactions, and you can even use mobile. If your game is going to be mobile enabled, you get to use the fact that the mobile gaming industry is actually the largest revenue generator in the entire industry at over $100 billion. You can talk about how mobile gaming, also, you know, I don't know if it's mobile enabled, but if it is, you got a lot of really awesome things you can play with, from demographics to money.
What would your advice be to someone who is looking and they're playing Fortnite and they see all of the new modes that are coming out and how you can actually make this a business now? What would your advice be to that realm of people who want to use that as a standing point to make a new studio or a new team?
Exclusively?
But that's a good point. It's like, should they be focused on it exclusively, or should they be looking at it as a test base for, you know, maybe getting user feedback on a new model in a standalone game? Or
yeah,
that's absolutely part of it.
Yeah, I am not a big proponent of necessarily building within an engine. The Fortnite editor, I think, is great to learn. There's a lot you can learn. It's not easy. So you are definitely learning. And I mean, I think, look, I place a lot. The reason I place so much importance on community building is because if you build a community, you already have an audience that's open and willing to just be a part of whatever you develop. Because really, they're now investing in you and what you are lending to their lives. So I can't speak to the Fortnite editor as much because I'm not even as versed in it. I think it's excellent. I think it presents opportunity to learn, to become more skilled within their respective engine. I do think the focus in general for any development studio is to leverage what is out there and be focused on building your own. I think Baldur's Gate is an excellent example of something that's just inspiring, right? Like, there are games that can just be done so well that the community responds to it. And I think as these communities continue to be built, and I want to be a really integral part of that, you have people, my goal is to have us as gamers waiting to hear about new releases in the indie scene. I actually want to transform independent game development so that it becomes as exciting as these massive titles that require hundreds of millions of dollars to market, if not billions, to market, because that's, I think, why the industry is doing a reset. I think the industry of gaming is doing a reset. Like, there are these titles. They made a bunch of money. There was a pandemic. Everything was leveraged. There are teams. There are franchises. So the esports model, they benefited from significantly. And now it's going back to just good games. They're laying off a ton of people because they hired a bunch of people that they may have needed at some point in the development process, but they were probably contractors, not necessarily employees. They're resetting and redefining. And I think it's an opportunity for a lot of indie games to now be in position to capitalize on all the platforms that are really being built, because I've noticed there are a lot of platforms that are at least being built because there's a need for the release, the publishing, the distribution of indie games. And at least on our end, I know we're building a platform that I'm really excited about, because from a perspective of a person who plays games extensively, who also cares about the creators of those games and the community of gamers, we get to lend our perspectives to these platforms so that we understand, you know, rev shares that really make sense, ways to increase discoverability so that the games that are built actually give the consumers a real reason to enjoy and play them, and that really reward the development community. Our goal is to create that cycle even in development on these platforms that we're building. But I think there's going to be a lot more of that. And I want developers to focus on just making their games so good that they can kind of start shopping them to other communities and companies that want in on development, that this is their way in.
Thank you.
Yes.
This has been fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on and doing this, and definitely want to catch up when we're out in Vegas.
Yes.
In a couple of weeks.
I love that.
Along those lines, before Dan, you know, gets all his plugs in, I want to remind everybody,
Dan the man,
if you are one of these people who made a game jam game, for a global game jam, or if you've made it in the past, did you just like wonder, okay, now what do I do? Because I made a game and it might be fun, but I don't know what to do next.
Right.
We are hosting a week long of sessions next week, a different session every day between myself and members of our team and Michael Brown from Vicarious. If I remember correctly, it's me, it's Pebs, who's our community manager, Heather, and Michael. And we're going to walk you through next week. Okay, you made a game jam game. Now what? This is how you turn into a business. So check it out. It's on the events thing in our calendar on the Discord. And with that, yes, Dan.
She said, no, not me, Margarita.
Oh, yes, Margaret. See, I know this is why I'm just in charge.
Is that what it is?
It's Margarita. Pabs is giving the talk at our conference. See, I was close.
Yeah. Everybody. Oh, that's going to be an awesome community manager one.
Dan, before you do your thing, I want to tell everybody that's listening, if you are in the New York area, there is a gaming hub for gamers, content creators, artists, developers, all the things. There are 20,000 free-to-play games. If you just want to come for a day pass, it's only $20, not $20 an hour. It is $20 for unlimited gaming all day. No re-entry unless you're a member. But if you're a member, look into the membership because there's a lot of really great stuff here. We tap into our community a lot. Classes, workshops, seminars, all those great things. Food, beverage, because we do eat, because we people. And we have a music studio, we have podcast areas, we have a lot of really great things and resources that we need. We'll be opening up new ones, but for now, we've got this one. It's available for us, and we'd love to coexist with you.
Are you close to the M&M store?
You know what? I don't know, but we're by Times Square, so we're kind of by.
It's like, in there. Thing. I know, because that was the only thing my son could talk about after we went to New York.
Yes, it's like a couple blocks, I think, from the M&M store.
Well, you know what? I never really wanted to go to New York, but that's like my wife's bucket list thing. I want to go to New York, and I'm like, well, maybe now I got a reason to go in someplace to hang out all evening, right? I
love that. That's awesome. And you and our drinks are all gamified and they're cool. And they're like anime names and Demon Slayers and the Alchemist and all kinds of fun stuff. So it's really great.
That sounds fun. That sounds super fun. This was a great talk and I'm excited for the shorts that are come out of this.
Yay.
So that's amazing. But thank you so much, Little J. Also, just Google Little J and check out some of her music as well.
Yeah, you can find me on Little J Music on everything. You can go to littlejmusic.com. We're out here being great.
That's awesome. So, with that being said, like you said, we've got the Global Game Jam stuff all next week. And then on the 20th and the 21st, that is I don't know which one it is. 13th?
15th.
15th.
We've done 15 of these freaking
things.
Wow. 15th online conference.
That's awesome.
So that's going to be amazing. We've got some amazing speakers for those 2 days. Plus, you can network on it. And just go to indiegamebusiness.com and check out our new website. Yes. Also, there's a link tree that's scrolling across the screen. It's linktree.com/indiegamebusiness. That's where all of the links live. You can get some awesome Indie Game Business podcast merch and some Indie Game Business merch and join our Discord, discord.gg/indiegamebusiness. That's the amazing hub and it's growing and growing and growing and growing. So super excited. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Have a great weekend.
Talk soon.
Thanks for listening to Indie Game Business. You can learn more about the show and our online business networking events at indiegame.business.